Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Hi, I'm Phil Craig.
And I'm Andrew Loney.
And together we aim to bring you the most scandalous stories and some of the most scandalous people in history. So thanks for joining us here on the Scandalmongers podcast.
Hello, a slight change this week. We're not doing a complete royal story, but we are going to talk with Di Davis at the beginning, giving his points of view on the Diana murder.
We are in another perhaps reckless experiment with our format. We're going to have two guests this week. And as Andrew said, the first one is, well, we did this weighty tome a few weeks ago, How They Murdered Diana. And I think it's fair to say that not everybody agrees with this thesis. And one of the people who doesn't agree is a previous guest who was the head of Royal Security, and he got back in touch. And we're going to be talking to him in a minute. And then after that, we're going to be talking... Well, you should introduce the sort of the main course of the of this particular...
Well, the main course we're talking to Adam Sisman, who's just published a second book on John le Carré. His first was The Authorised Life, but there was much in The Authorised Life he couldn't write about while John le Carré and his wife were alive. And he's just done another book, which I think is a fascinating account, not just of le Carré's love life, but actually of the problems biographers have in their relationship with particularly living subjects and family, and how far the private life intrudes on the public life and how important it is, which is a subject which interests me. So I'm really looking forward to talking to him. He's a very good biographer, very wide-ranging, and I'm sure he'll have some very interesting things to say.
Good. Well, an absolutely jam-packed episode. I think we should start, though, with a little bit of boasting. This has been, if not our best week ever, probably our second best week. I keep my eye on the data. The show we did with Lady Colin Campbell has already got 8,000 views on YouTube, but it's also brought a lot of new people. I'm going to mention a few of them by name in a minute. So overall, I think we had 11,000 views. That's just on the YouTube. That doesn't count the people who are listening. So thank you. If you're one of those new people who found us, please hang around and please stay.
We have lots of good stuff coming up. I think we're hoping to talk to Richard Kay next week, who is probably the most respected royal journalist in Britain.
Yeah. Very close relationship. We're not done with the royals yet. We are not done with them yet.
Well, you seem to like royals, so we'll keep coming back to them.
Let me. Do you want to hear some comments?
Yeah.
Okay. A newbie here, Christina Coates, who's found us through the Lady Colin Campbell show. She's really enjoying everything that we're doing. Jay Taylor as well. Gite Ducam, I'm guessing maybe French, maybe I'm pronouncing that wrong. Iona Marilyn, maybe that's Marilyn Iona. And this one I love. You know, the other day somebody said you were dishy.
And no, they say you dishy.
Oh, well, maybe they said we were both dishy. this is the best compliment you'll ever get in your career. Robert Smuggles, 6871, says most royal biographers are like hagfish, a slimy marine fish that specializes in sucking the fluids from living creatures. But Andrew Lodi is no hagfish. His books are based on facts, not innuendo and prejudice. There you are.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much, Robert. Yes, I try hard.
Actually, somebody else has pointed out that we seem to have the same name now. And if you've noticed, our personalities have melded. So on Zoom, we have the same name. This is because we used to go on and on about how mean we were. We couldn't afford a professional Zoom account. And then guess what? It turned out Andrew had one all the time.
Well, I bought one. I felt sorry for the fact we were only doing 40 minutes.
Okay, well, you have to offset that against the many, many thousands of pounds we'll be earning a week anytime soon. Okay, enough showing off. Shall we give the people what they want?
Yes, I think I can't wait to hear what Di has to say.
Yeah, so we're going to talk to Di, and then straight after that, we're going to go into this longer interview on Le Carré. And if you're not interested in Diana's murder, it's very easy to just skip forward to part two. But let's hope you enjoyed all. See you later.
Thanks a lot. See you next week.
Di, welcome back.
Well, thank you. So soon.
Well, we thought you may have some thoughts on this work that we discussed last week.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, I certainly have, having given hundreds of lectures on the very subject of the death of Diana. I listened with interest, and I respect everybody's point of view. But as I said to you privately, you know what I think of what he said.
Yeah, I mean, I think we were both pretty skeptical. There are some areas where I felt he said things that seemed quite intriguing, plausible. Maybe you can shoot them down. I mean, the one about MI6 activity in Paris, does that not look a little suspicious?
Absolutely not. There were two officers actually in Paris at the embassy at that time. And as I understood, both were away with their families having a break that weekend. So, I don't find it suspicious that MI6 have a presence in France. What I do find fatuous is the fact that anybody would think that His Royal Highness, the Duke of Edinburgh, could persuade so many people in so many different outfits to actually come together to conspire. And we can talk more about that. But no, nothing that MI6 did, or the two operatives that I know of, and what they did do that weekend, causes me any concern at all.
And what about some of the questions, for example, about changing testimony, Henri having unexplained sums of money, and blood samples? I mean, you know, there were quite a series of points that were made.
Well, we'd have to go back to actually who made them. And if we go back to, it was Mohammed Fayed, and the first thing he said was that Prince Philip, a German Nazi, murdered Diana. So that's the bedrock on which all these conspiracies and other factors lie on. So if we actually take it apart, as it were, he made over 178 different allegations. And according to two independent investigations, not one of them actually was proven. And in fact, his head of security, a former colleague of mine, was actually proved to be a liar when he was tested at the inquest. So I take all of these with a huge pinch of salt. Now, in terms of Henri Paul and his money...
Sorry to interrupt, but didn't the inquest rule that they'd been unlawfully killed?
Unlawfully killed by a drunken driver.
Right.
By a drunken driver, because to drive when you've got 3.5 times the legal limit in you in France is illegal, and it would be the same in this country, which would be twice over. And let's deal with that. Three separate samples were taken in respect of Henri Paul, and two of them were witnessed by the head of the then criminal department, also by a pathologist, and they were tested, and they were found to have always the same amount of alcohol in them. He wasn't drunk, because it's alleged, or he was an alcoholic. And when I give a lecture on a cruise ship, I always challenge sometimes up to 1,000 people in that audience to challenge me if they buy me a litre of wine. And having been drinking since I was about 14 years of age, I can assure you I can do my shoelaces having drunk a litre of wine. I'm not drunk, but I can do it. And I've proven it to people, particularly if they buy the litre of wine. So no, there's irrefutable, if that's the right word, on a Monday morning, evidence to show that independent analysis were taken, and each time they showed that the blood was taken from him. And I believe that, unless you again go to the conspiracy that all these people conspired to swap samples. As an investigator who's investigated crimes, you look at motive, you look at opportunity, and then the suspects, who are they capable? And I've looked at this now for, 12, 14, 15 years, however long it is now, fairly seriously, and I've stood the test because I've done this, as I said, 150 times to varying audience from 1,000 to 3 or 4. And I challenge anyone to come up with new evidence. And I've heard nothing, including your gentleman that was on your show, that proved anything new. Now, you mentioned the money. Well, he was 43 years of age, a single man, although he did have a girlfriend who had a child, not by him. But he was regularly paid huge amounts of money, either to do favors for certain very, very rich Saudis and others. So over the period of years, and he was the deputy head of security, as you know, he amounted quite a lot of money. And so I think from memory, it was about 400,000 francs at the time, which is quite a lot of money. But if you're single, he liked to smoke. He did certainly like to drink, as we know. So it's not a huge amount, because he was paid sometimes 5,000 up to 10,000. And again, I don't want to delve into what kind of favors he did, but it is a matter of record. Even his own parents said that he had gone out and done favors for people. So with very rich people staying in that hotel, it wouldn't take you long to amass quite a lot of money.
Mm. And what about James Anderson? I mean, and his mysterious
James Anderson,
death?
Yes. Well, again, he had said many times to friends that if he was going to commit suicide, he would do it in the way that he did. And it's independent evidence shows that he went and filled his car up with petrol, but he also filled a can of petrol, again, independently verified by Scotland Yard and indeed the French police. And the nonsense that he said he'd been sort of shot in the head, well, the actual hole in the head, it'd be very difficult to do that with a gun yourself, is actually the implosion of the heat and the combustion that went into that. So, no, I'm more than happy. And James Anderson, by the way, on the night in question, had gone home earlier. He had been in the south of France in various parts, and he was a member of the paparazzi, who particularly looked to Diana. But he'd gone home, and it's proven that he had a motorway ticket showing that at about 3 a.m., 3:30, he was on the motorway going to an airport because he had an assignment in Corsica. And there was a plane ticket, and he was on the plane manifest. So, again, this shows what nonsense. And it was McNamara, the ex-chief superintendent from the Met, who came up with some of this nonsense. And he would do whatever his master bidded. And sadly, he's dead now, so he can't challenge. But I've challenged him, and I've challenged him publicly, and nobody sued me yet.
Do you think that there's a chance this man, Anderson, was the driver of the Fiat Uno?
No, not at all. The driver of the vehicle, and I'm 100%, and I've said this for many years, was Lee Van Tan, who was a security guard at a Renault factory, who was entitled to a break out at around that time because he started work at 7 a.m. He was the one, the very morning after the accident, painted his car red, and you can see the marks. He was also identified by two French people, very educated, two husband and wife, who saw him driving with a big black dog in the back who had a bandana around its neck. And guess who had a big black dog in a white Fiat? But this fellow. So no, 100%, and even Lord Stevens now agrees with me, and I was saying it years before he did. Why the French cocked it up, I don't know. And that's a question I would ask. Why didn't they take better samples, etc., and interrogate him better? But I don't know. They did arrest Lee Van Tan. But I stand by that. And
you
again,
if the Uno came into contact with the Mercedes, it was a consequence of the accident in progress.
It wouldn't. Even that would not have caused it. What it would do was to show somebody who's driving over the limit. It would put you off driving. And I'm a retired advanced driver. I was both as a constable and back as a superintendent. I did courses. And what I'm trying to tell you is you drive at 70, 80, 90 miles an hour, as he was doing, it's alleged. And then somebody hits you, it'll put you off. Now, it's bad enough, and I've done defensive driving with BMW and others, you know, where you drive 100 miles an hour And you deliberately drive into things, I can assure you, even with being sober, just a small deflection of that will put you off. Now, when you're sober and you're trained, you can deal with it. But he was neither sober and neither was he trained. And in fact, in fairness to him, he never expected to have been driving. It's only because nobody said no. And what is important is Diana never intended to be in Paris that weekend because she intended to be away in Vienna with her friend, the handbag designer, Lena Marx. So it was very much a last-minute request. And as I've told you and I've done over the years, is study. In fact, I'm just producing a history of attacks in Europe in the Victorian days. You know, you take time to plan this. If you look at any anarchists or any normally, they take time to plan it. Now, for anyone to take this length of short time to plan this, particularly when you're being followed by people taking photographs, beggars belief, even if you believe, you know, the foundation of the story, which I simply don't.
Okay.
Well, and this idea that they were engaged and he'd bought a ring.
No, well, let me deal with the engagement nonsense. That's another bit of lie, which was proven by the Paget report that they hadn't gone into the Rapponzi jewelers in Monte Carlo. The three bodyguards or protection officers paid all said that never happened. They never sent a ring because they never went there in the first place to Italy to have it remeasured. And that was proven because Dodi went into the Rapponzi jewelry just very nearby to the Ritz and actually chose from an array of rings. So all the nonsense that they'd chosen a ring and so on and so forth. I've no doubt he may have given her, I was going to give her a ring. That's why they went back to the Elysee where they had the apartment. But again, nobody expected them to go back to the Ritz. They were going for dinner in a restaurant. And because there were so many paparazzi, so just before eight, they cancelled that and went back to the Ritz. So nobody, if you're going to plan this, you've got to actually know the routes, timing and all the rest of it. Well, nobody knew it until very, very late. And it was only Fayed himself who decided on the devious tactics of going through the back way. But Henri Paul, as you know or may know, went out and said, catch me if you can to the front people. It was complete illogical what he did and the way he drove. But clearly he'd had some drink. He even had two Ricards, as it's known, a licorice-based drink, actually, while they were waiting to decide on what the plan would be. So if you put it all together, it just amounts to very little, in my opinion.
It seems crazy also to leave the Ritz. Why couldn't they borrow a toothbrush and stay the night there?
Well, absolutely. You're absolutely right, and it's a fantastic place. I haven't actually been there myself. I have in London, and that's pretty good. So the equivalent. No, you're absolutely right. And if you take all these apart, as I have, and I've read the Paget report, all 878 pages of it, so many times. Yes, of course, there are areas you think, well, why didn't you do that? But if you take it as a whole, and of course, Lord Stevens took great umbrage when he was then alleged to be part of the plot. You know, and to think that all these various professionals, both in this country and others, would all team together. And the other factor is she'd been happily going to marry Hazrat Khan, a Muslim, albeit from a very different part of the world, Pakistan. Nobody cared about that. So nobody's even suggested that anyone would plot to kill either Hasnat or her for that. And I can go through all of this. And again, I was in charge when that so-called letter went to Michon Duray. And again, my commissioner and then the assistant commissioner.
This is Diana's letter, isn't it?
When
Diana said she was worried that somebody was out to get her.
Yeah, and again, she got that all wrong because she was going through a paranoid time. And even William acknowledges that she was paranoid at the time. And again, she got that all wrong because she alleged it wasn't Camilla. It was Teggy Lee Burke, the old nanny. So again, if you actually disseminate it, and the truth is, Michon Duray and the commissioner, Lord Condon as he is now, and my boss, Sir David Burness, all decided on the evidence that it was Diana being Diana, as she was in that particular time, very sadly. And again, one of my former sergeants, he then set up a private company to actually debug places. And he went there three times, as I understand it, gave her phones and all kinds of things. And again, there was no evidence to show that any bugging was taking place. And let me deal with the issue. Well, the British government were peed off with it. It was a junior minister called Lord Howe, who subsequently became a senior minister under Thatcher. He called her a name and said she was a loose cannon. But that's the only evidence that anyone has said anything about her activity with regards to minefields. So no, nobody has persuaded me. And as I said, I've spent half a century investigating from home and all around the world doing strange cases. I assure you, in my professional opinion, on anything that's dear to me, this was an accident, 100%.
Well, that's brilliant of you to share your knowledge. Thank you for coming back to round two with us. Appreciate it.
Well, round three, if you like. I like a fight.
Well, no. I think it's very interesting to have this balance to what we were being presented with before. And I mean, Richard Tomlinson's claims that the MI6 assassinate people, are those, again, pretty dubious?
Well, very dubious. And Tomlinson himself, with all huge respect to himself, as you know, was jailed for breaking the Official Secrets Act. And in his first book that he wrote, or the first memorandum to that book, no mention of this at all. Yes, some very low down had suggested, not Slobodanovich or whatever his name was, but another, that they could use a strobe. But the accident reconstruction of the accident at the Alma Tunnel showed, both by the French and the expert British vehicle examiners and accident examiners, show the accident would have happened with or without a light. It was going to happen before he entered because of the speed and the distance and so on. The other factor, I would say, if they'd been wearing seatbelts, this was survivable. And how could anybody judge whether they were going to wear seatbelts or not? Why they didn't is beyond me.
All right. Well, I think we should probably leave it there, Andrew, because we've got to cram two other interviews into this program.
It's going to be a bumper edition, Di.
But I actually look forward to listening. I do enjoy your cast, and I enjoy and share your cynicism on occasion.
Well, thank you so much for your time again, and I hope we will look forward to getting you back for round three. Cheers, Di.
Okay, sir. Thank you. Okay. Bye.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye, Di.
Bye.
Well, Adam, thank you so much for joining us to talk about Le Carré and your second book on him. And I suppose my first question is, why did you feel you needed to write a second book?
Well, there were quite a lot of things that, when I was writing my biography that was published in 2015, that David Cornwall, that's John Le Carré's real name, didn't want me to include. And these were mostly, but not entirely, connected with his personal life, which he had warned me, to be fair to him, at the outset, was going to be a problem. I didn't realize how much of a problem it would be, or the scale of the thing. And as I progressed, David became increasingly agitated about what I would write, and things reached a point where it seemed sensible for his eldest son, Simon, to intervene. Simon came down to visit me at my house in Bristol, where I'm speaking to you from now, and we spent a day together. And he recommended that I keep a secret annex of material for later publication, and that secret annex is the core of this new book.
Sounds very Le Carré language, secret annexes,
agendas,
meetings. And I mean, I'm very jealous, actually, that you had the chance to work with one of my favourite ever writers. But it must have been quite odd to set out to write a truthful book about somebody who is written about liars and was kind of a liar himself.
Kind of a liar. He was a self-confessed liar. He said on more than one occasion, "I'm a liar, born to be a liar, raised to be a liar, trained to be a liar in the service of my country, and then practicing as a novelist who, after all, writes fiction." So, yes, he was, and as I discovered, also a liar in his private life. So, yes, I mean, and I always felt that he was at least one step ahead of me, I hasten to add. So I've just heard the doorbell ring. Is that a problem?
Not at all. Answer it if you like.
Well, I'm just worried that nobody else will. What can we do? Can we stop the...
We can stop.
Well, I usually just carry my laptop with me, but maybe you're not on a laptop.
I am on a laptop, but it's quite long. Pause for a moment.
We'll pause and we'll edit this little bit out.
Okay.
Thank you. Oh, my God, I hope it's not a hitman. You survived.
I'm so sorry about that.
No, we said it would be a very appropriate kind of Le Carre twist if you left the room and just didn't come back.
Yes. Alas, it wasn't anything very exciting. It was simply the dreaded Amazon, one of the penalties of working at home.
He was alive, in his private life. And I mean, in some ways, justification for this book is it does give us a new insight into his writing, really, that the man... it's a wonderful study of a relationship between a biographer and the subject.
Yes, there are two. If I can unpick that, I think there are different points there. There's it's certainly true, I think, that his clandestine life acted as a kind of fuel for his writing and an inspiration for his writing. And he said over and over again that. He needed to have this kind of stimulus. In a way, he was playing at spying. You know, the life of a writer is not a very interesting life, as you both know. Even more, I know. You sit at home and in front of your laptop, and occasionally are interrupted by delivery drivers. I think David missed the excitement, both the excitement of operational life, but also the excitement of knowing things that other people didn't know, the secrecy. I think he often said to me that one of the things that most appealed him about, he was first with MI5 and then with 6, but right from the start with MI5 was that sense of being part of a brotherhood that knew things that other people didn't know and knew what was really going on was the implication. And I suppose having a secret life, a secret private life, is also a bit like that. Mm. You know, you have a life that nobody else knows about. And
I guess the difference is, though, you're not betraying your country, you're betraying your wife.
You're betraying your wife.
And how aware or even complicit was she in these betrayals? Do you know?
I know it to some extent. She was generally aware that there were things going on. She didn't know the details, and she was upset by it. For example, my friend Nicholas Shakespeare told me that he was present back in the early 1990s during a. When they at an embarrassing scene where she suddenly burst out, "I don't want to spend your birthday with you if you're going to be thinking about her," whichever her that was at the time. At a late stage of writing my 2015 biography, David arranged for me to have a private interview with Jane, his wife. He ushered me into her presence at their house in Hampstead and then went for a walk on Hampstead Heath, leaving the two of us together. And I don't know which of us was the more uncomfortable about to have a conversation about his infidelities. Wow. And she clearly was embarrassed by this, and I was too. And it felt to me as if she was coming out with lines that have been carefully rehearsed by the man who was walking on the heath. In fact, I felt as if we were both puppets being manipulated by the master spy, you might say.
Did the lovers feel they were manipulated?
Several of them used the term that they felt they were being run like an agent. And that's the other curious thing about it all, is that he used all the tradecraft that he'd learnt working for 5 and 6 in the course of his private life. So he used codes, cutouts, dead letter boxes, safe houses, and indeed referred to them as such. So, for example, he asked various friends to act as cutouts where they would receive post. And keep it for him until he picked it up so that it wouldn't arrive at the house and the incriminating letters wouldn't be sitting on the popping through the letterbox at home. That was just one example. Some of them were quite very curious. I mean, for example, he always booked into hotels under assumed names, though nobody knew who Cornwell was. And one of the advantages of having a pseudonym is it makes you anonymous.
But then you make the point that when he met famous people like Freddie Forsyth, he would then go and with the girlfriend and go and have a brandy and, you know, be very open in some ways. I mean, he was almost courting danger.
Yes, I don't think in that particular instance he had a huge amount of choice, and they assumed that she was his wife and he didn't disabuse them. But no, I mean, you're right. He did like to flaunt danger. And for example, he took Sue Dawson to a restaurant where he knew he would be seen by other writers, where Harold Pinter, for example, regularly went. I think David got a kick out of being there with an attractive young woman and being seen to be there with an attractive young woman.
You mentioned Sue Dawson. She's gone public on the relationship and written a book about it. Are there others? I mean, were others concerned about the fact you were going to write about the relationship? I mean, you've kept them very much anonymous, many of them.
Yes. I consulted them all, and anyone who didn't want to be identified, I didn't identify. Although, curiously, another two have emerged since the book went to press. I'm sure there are a great many more as well. I mean, one of the things that's very striking is how much time and effort, not to mention cash, he put into these affairs. I'm surprised he had time to write any books, really. But he did say over and over again, I mean, his patter was say, you know, my marriage is stale, I have no inspiration, but you've got me writing again. With you, I'm back at my best. And to a certain sort of young woman or woman, this was very appealing. To act as a kind of muse, or even some kind of co-writer. So that was that was one of his. But I think there was a truth in that. I think he did seem to need that. And in fact, it's noticeable that when he finally quit the field, his books become much less interesting and much less good, frankly.
I mean, I think it's fascinating. You talk about them also being muses. Do you think that really was the case in terms of energizing him, or was he just basically, this was a great chat-up line?
Sounds a bit like Picasso picking up 60-year-old girls when he's 80, saying he needs a new muse, and a surprising number of people do fall for that.
Yes. I think one reason they fall for it is that it's partly true. I mean, he was sincere, at any rate. Who can say whether it was really true or not? I mean, I think that at the moment he was saying that, he was probably being truthful. I mean, how do we know? We can't look inside his head. It's just my sense. The last woman I know that he was involved with, who was more than 50 years younger than him and who had been married and has children, told me that her relationship with David was the most important in her life. So that gives you a sense of it. I've talked to her great, and she chose not to be named, as a matter of fact.
I mean, he must have been great company, you know. He must have been a charismatic person to have in your life, I imagine.
There's no question of that. I mean, I can easily see what... I mean, Nicholas Shakespeare says of him that he was like Bruce Chatwin in this sense. It didn't really matter whether you were a woman or a man or an ocelot. He had seduced you. And if he wanted to make you love him, he could easily do that. And I certainly felt the charm of his presence, and often had to pinch myself and say, we're not really friends at all. And probably as soon as you walk out of the door, he'll go, you know, to Jane. And I found out later he did say rude things about me to other people. But then I knew he would. And he said that's one of the least attractive of his qualities, I found, was that he badmouths almost everyone. Well, everyone. He badmouths his agent, his editor, his publisher, his...
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
His wife, his children, and even old friends. And to me, I was puzzled by that. It didn't seem to me that I felt that was beneath him, and I didn't understand why he felt the need to belittle people.
And what sort of father was he?
Well, he felt that he was an inadequate father, partly because he had left the mother of his three children of his first marriage, and that one of them in particular, the youngest, Tim, he felt had suffered as a result. Tim was bipolar. Whether or not that had anything to do with the breakup of his parents' marriage, we can't know. But David certainly was worried that he was, and was very anxious about Tim's condition. He was affectionate in that sense, but in another sense, he was rather distant. I perhaps illustrate this by saying I remember visiting the house very soon after the birth of Jane's first grandchild, the first child of the son of his second marriage, Nick Cornwall, who writes under the name Nick Harkaway. And Jane was glowing with pleasure, and I congratulated her, and she was very, very happy, you know, that this was a big moment in her life. And a little later on, I was shown in to see David, and I congratulated him. And he assumed I was talking about some review of his latest book, and he had no idea what I was talking about. It didn't mean anything to him.
Oh, that's so interesting.
But do you think a lot of this goes back to his childhood? I mean, the fact that his mother abandoned him, he had a father who was a con artist, not similar background to Jeffrey Archer. And this made him very difficult for him to establish relationships and to feel secure in a family environment.
I think all of those things, that's definitely true. It's a very, very dysfunctional family. His mother abandoned him when he was only 5 years old, him and his elder brother, and didn't come back. And he was left with the feeling that women will always let you down, will always leave, will always abandon you. And the policy he adopted was to abandon them before they abandoned you. And time after time, what he seemed to do with these women is to say, I love you, you're marvellous, you've got me writing again, you're the one, my marriage is stale, come and live with me, you know, we'll make a new life, etc., etc. And gradually they would be won over. This isn't the inevitable pattern, but this is the sort of general pattern. And almost as soon as they said, okay, I'm ready to jump ship with you, or whatever the right expression is, he would rapidly cool off and soon afterwards cut contact altogether.
Well, it's listening to you talk about it. You said you found him charming and he could seduce anybody, but he doesn't have come across as a sort of self-centered, grubby bastard, to be honest, but maybe that's part of it.
I think he didn't have, in this childhood, Sue Dawson said something which I think is very true, actually. She said, those to whom damage is done do damage in return. I think he didn't have real feelings, or at least he didn't trust his feelings if he had them. And so he was very skeptical about any kind of love or affection. He mistrusted it, he was also very, very odd with male friends. He didn't really have any friends, not any friends that in the normal sense. And in fact, one of the things that he it was so common that it too became a pattern was that if any other male writer criticized his work, or offered constructive criticism, which is what it would always be, he would go out of his way to seduce that man's wife. That was clearly a policy for him.
Okay, so he's Bill Hayden. He's Bill Hayden from Tinker Tailor, I think.
Yes, maybe he is.
I don't know. I mean, it just came to me. I mean, did it change your pleasure in the books? Do you still read them with pleasure? Or maybe you read them with more pleasure now you know the man. You knew him so well.
It's funny you say this because I'm just writing something about that at this moment. I mean, I think that I distinguish in my mind between David Cornwell and John le Carré. And so when I read a John le Carré, I still get the same pleasure. And I admire him enormously as a writer, perhaps more than most people, I don't know. And not all his books, but his best books, I think are extremely good. As a person, I think he's very flawed, and I'm quite sceptical of his... I'm quite cynical about him, perhaps is a better way of putting it.
I'm guessing you work with him while they were making that film of Tinker Tailor, which I think he's actually in very briefly.
He's in all the recent films. He's made it a sort of signature. So he was in the film of Our Kind of Traitor. He was in the film of The Night Manager, the television series, and then in The Little Drummer Girl. He's played parts ranging from a policeman to an attendant at the zoo to a diner in a restaurant, that sort of thing.
I love that. I love the Tinker Tailor. Did he like it? Did he slag it off as well? Or did he actually like that film? I thought it was terrific.
The new Tinker Tailor, as it were.
Yeah, the 2015 one.
Yes. He did. I mean, one of his characteristics, which actually I rather admire, is to always be positive about the latest thing. I personally completely disagree with you. I don't think it's a patch on the original television series. I think it's a muddled film. And I think they made some bad decisions, like for example, making Peter Gwillan gay, which I think completely changes the relationship with Smiley. I think part of the interesting thing about Gwillan, you know, the book is told through Gwillan's point of view. And Gwillan himself is having problems with a woman that he doesn't understand, just as Smiley has these problems with Anne. And there's a kind of parallel there, which is lost if Gwillan is gay. I know it's only a small point, but it's one of many. I felt that the device, for example, for identifying the potential traitor of having these photographs attached to chess pieces was a clumsy, crude device. But you know, I'm disappointed.
Happy to be contradicted. I'll go back to the.
I think it's perfectly. But you know, every point of view is valid, and he certainly very much enjoyed it. I was with him most during the sort of early planning of the Night Manager, and I can remember, for example, him telling. I asked him who's going to play Roper. And I was stunned when he said that Hugh Laurie was going to play the worst man in the world, which is how Roper is described, the arms dealer Roper. Mm-hmm. I said, surely that's a mistake. But actually, I think it was a brilliant piece.
Oh, he was amazing. He was very sinister and very good. Very charming and sinister at the same time.
Yeah. Very good, I think. I think Tom Hollander stole the whole thing while he was on screen, but he was on a secondary role, of course. But anyway, that's another point. But no, David was reading the scripts and talking about them and certainly very involved while I was talking to him. And this is over a period of years. So I felt in some ways I got to know him very well, and perhaps arguably as well as anyone ever has done. I think he was incapable of real feeling in the sense of abandoning himself to real feeling. He was mistrustful of feeling, mistrustful of emotion. I think that was the damage that his mother and his father too. I mean, as Andrew said at the beginning, his father, well, apart from anything else, his father abused his children, sexually abused his children. So that's a betrayal of trust, if ever there was one.
Sure, God.
And do you feel that in some ways, I mean, his depiction of the intelligence world is accurate, or is it just he has a good feel for things, and in some ways he's created a world that we believe in, but actually isn't the reality?
I think the latter. I think, I mean, you know, I'm not to know. I've never been in the intelligence world, but my And I think the thing that you feel with those the best books is that they feel authentic. And that was certainly the overwhelming reaction when they came out, with The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, for example. I mean, people said, this is an antidote to all those James Bond nonsense, which is what it's really like. There was an emotional truth there, even if there wasn't a kind of literal truth. But I think it was Dick White is said to have said to Alan Dulles, you know, it's far too complicated a double agent operation ever to have worked in the Spy Who Came In From the Cold. Other people have commented that David was never really involved in a successful operation himself. But I think they, as I say, they feel true, and they're true in another way. I think they're true in reflecting some of the ambiguous feelings that Britons of a certain generation, and particularly Britons maybe working closely alongside Americans, felt about our American allies and about Britain's diminished role in the world. I think he nails that very well. He's got a very good sense of that. A sense of keeping up a pretense, or at least the carapace of empire, even when the empire itself has sort of disintegrated from within.
Because, I mean, you made the point in the book that actually he was never a very, as you say, successful or even very high-level intelligence officer.
Very low-level. To be fair to him, he did say that on more than one occasion, but he always said it in such a way as to suggest to the public that maybe he was not telling the whole truth and that really he had some more important role than he was giving out. He didn't. And you can see in the volume of letters that was published posthumously him trying to have a role when he meets the Russian ambassador in the, I think it's in the 2000s, and makes contact contacts within MI6, within SIS, but nothing really happened, and it wasn't. I mean, there weren't any secrets that were on offer or indeed given. The whole thing was a bit of a fantasy.
And I mean, that's presumably why he was drawn to the secret world. I mean, he was a fantasist, and in some ways, the secret world gave him his material. But double life that he had in his private life, in some ways, came before the double life in the public life.
I think. I mean, my understanding is that one of the things that people, his contemporaries in intelligence, both in MI5 and in MI6, resented was his emphasis on betrayal. That although, of course, that there are all the cases of betrayal that we know about, that indeed that you wrote about, Andrew, with Guy Burgess or MacLean or Philby, betrayal wasn't so universal as his books maybe suggest that it is. I think Tinker Tailor seems to me to be quintessentially about Philby, and indeed there are certain echoes of what really happened with Philby, such as when Irena, Ricky Tarr's informant, who first alerts the circus to the possibility that there is a mole buried deep within British intelligence, is taken back to Russia wrapped in bandages, just as a defector who Philby was supposed to have brought in, who was waiting for a British contact in Istanbul. He was also taken back to Russia, wrapped in bandages, and never seen alive again. There are all sorts of details that suggest a parallel between Bill Hayden and Kim Philby, which we don't need to go into here. But I think it's clearly based on that.
So did he know that once he died, you would reveal all about the sort of secret sexual side of his life? Or were you not sure that was going to happen?
I wasn't sure that was going to happen, but we had, he said, I don't really mind what you write about me after I don't mind what you write about me after I'm dead. He knew about the the plan for this secret annex. But I myself didn't really have a... I originally thought in terms of an updated version of the... a new edition of the biography. And I really only didn't proceed with that for pure publishing reasons. My editor had left the publishing house that published it, and there wasn't great enthusiasm for a new edition from the new regime, as often happens when you lose your editor. So I, at that point, I started to think of going down a different route.
But I think you've made the point that actually you couldn't really have written this except in the way that you have done. It is this dialogue that you're having with yourself about the justification. I mean, you've always said in the past that you stopped at the bedroom door. Here you've had to go slightly further.
Yes. Well, I've gone slightly further. But I mean, as I mean, you mentioned that analogy, and it's referring to Janet Malcolm and in The Silent Woman. But I have done quite a lot of clearing of my throat outside the bedroom door and, you know, kind of tapping on the door before I go in, and haven't really revealed what I saw in there, unlike some people. So I think that it isn't really about what's behind the bedroom door as the fact that something is happening behind the bedroom door, and that is bears a relation to his writing. If it didn't, there wouldn't be any point in writing about it, I think. And also helps to tell us more about this very complicated man who, after all, you know, wrote continually about betrayal, and betrayal was a guiding principle in his private life. So I didn't really, we didn't really talk about the second half of what you said much earlier, Andrew, which is that the book also talks about my attempts to negotiate with him and the difficulties that we had during the writing of the book. I decided at an early stage that I couldn't hide anything from him, and that I had to be frank with him. So when I was tipped off about the existence of Sue Dawson, for example, I told him at after I'd met her, and so on. I didn't go particularly looking for mistresses, I might say. I came across them in the most random way. I mean, I heard about one mistress when some friends invited me to lunch in the country near Bath, or I heard about another one late one night at a party from someone I just met, who said, a friend of mine's mother had a long affair with John le Carré, and so on. They kept popping up, and I'm sure there are a lot more that I haven't come across. I know there is.
Still time, I suppose. I mean, because you also write, I mean, for one woman, it really destroyed her life, and her mother remonstrated with le Carré, didn't she?
More than remonstrated. She wrote a very angry, bitter letter saying, "It is a great regret to me that she wore her ring. She wore your ring until the day she died." She'd persuade this woman who'd been his secretary, who was in love with him, who he'd seduced, and then abandoned, but she persuaded him to buy her ring, which he wore on her finger as if they were engaged for the next, whatever it was, for 30-odd years.
That is really sad. Gosh.
It was very sad. And she never married, never had children, never had a life, really. She was always in love with David. And I've come across several people who were, well, I mean, if you read the review of my book in the Current Literary Review, I don't know if you've seen it yet, Andrew.
I haven't seen it yet, sadly, but I can imagine, because that was a long, long affair.
I think you can see that she too, that reviewer, is still in love with David. Although she seems to somehow be angry with me, as if I was the one who had dumped her, not David.
Gosh. And I mean, some of these people who died, I mean, you haven't named them. Is that just because you just don't know what they would have felt, or the family didn't want them to be named?
Oh, I've named some. I mean, Yvette Pierpaoli was semi-public. He did himself write. He didn't admit to having had an affair with her, but he wrote about her as as he wrote a piece about her called The Constant Muse, and how she how influenced he had been by her. She died in the Bosnian War. She was an aid worker, and the car she was traveling in Albania, I think, crashed into a ravine. And then there was another woman. In fact, the one I was talking about, the late night at the party, the mother of a friend, she committed suicide. She was one of those women who seems to get passed from man to man. It was a rather very sad story. Another woman, Janet Lee Stevens, and I do name her. She was known as Lisa Denise. That was a made-up name, but that was her name. And I think she's the inspiration. Well, I'm sure she is the inspiration for Lizzie Worthington in The Honourable Schoolboy. Once you start to think about it, it's obvious. There was Janet Lee Stevens, who was blown up in the Lebanon bomb, the one that blew up in the American embassy in Beirut, who was an aid worker, very much a champion of the Palestinians, and possibly a CIA agent. And there are rumors that she was. Of course, you know, what is a CIA agent? What is an MI6 agent? I mean, it's how long is a piece of string? Incidentally, I mean, the Little Drummer's Girl, the Little Drummer Girl, the book that David published about the set against the background of the struggle between the Palestinians and the Israelis, I think holds up extremely well. Perhaps sadly, it's just as relevant in 2023 as it was when it was published in 1983. What's that, 40 years before? Yes.
Another great adaptation, I thought Florence Pugh was fantastic in that.
Well, I agree. I think she was absolutely tremendous in that. There was an earlier Hollywood adaptation where they insist on having a big Hollywood star, and they disastrous piece of miscasting. Diane Keaton was played the role of the of Charlie. And Diane Keaton had to pretend to be a left-wing English actress. Well, you can see how that wouldn't work. and it didn't work. It was a total muddle of a film, sadly.
I mean, do you think he's going to continue to be read? I mean, you talk about him being a major novelist, particularly for those Cold War novels, but in some ways it's the other novels which are getting attention now, partly perhaps because they weren't filmed before. But, I mean, do you see his reputation rising? I mean, particularly after your books? Maybe not.
It would be immodest for me to suggest that it's anything to do with my books. I think that with every novelist, there comes a reckoning after they die, in the years after they die. And it happens quite quickly that people often who... where they haven't been truthful before, say what they really think. I mean, one of the things that has surprised me about David in the time that I've known him is how his later books have gained almost universal praise, although in my opinion they are manifestly inferior to his earlier books. And in fact, the last few, I think, weren't worth publishing at all. Whereas his great books, the books of his blue period, if you like, received rather mixed reviews. I think those books, I mean, my judgment, for what it's worth, is that those books will survive. There'll be a sorting out and people will judge him by his four or five best books. And they'll go back to him for two real reasons. I mean, they're fairly obvious, I suppose. One is that I think he's the definitive Cold War novelist. And also because I think he is a novelist of sort of the post-imperial end of empire, yes, and of the conflicting feelings that caused to a generation of our countrymen and the difficulties in adapting to that. Blake Morrison rather neatly used the phrase laureate of Britain's post-imperial sleepwalk. And I thought that was a very neat way of putting it. I also think that the Honourable Schoolboy, which in some ways is a flawed book, but has brilliant passages, is a very good book about the collapse of Western influence in Southeast Asia in the 1970s, about Vietnam, but also about, you know, Cambodia and Laos. And I think it's all there if you read that book. And in many ways it's more convincing. It's as good as perhaps The Quiet American, I think.
You talked to a lot of people who really knew things, didn't he? He did a lot of research and had high-level contacts.
He did. And he liked to go out into the field. For that book, for example, I mean, he had a very close encounter with communist guerrillas who, he was in a taxi outside Phnom Penh in the country, and they stopped him in the rain, and machine guns were pushed through the window and submachine guns, for a while it looked pretty dicey until they eventually were released and allowed to go back into the city. He did have very good contacts. And he did do his work on the ground. Often he would do the research not before he started work, but towards the end, to confirm what he'd already imagined.
Gosh, interesting. Yeah. Interesting.
So just my final question, because we are getting a little bit short of time, and you'll have been asked this about 20 times already, I'm sure. If you had to come down, is he Smiley? Is he Carla?
Oh, I don't think I have ever been asked that. Well, I don't think he's either. I say in my book he was no George Smiley. I mean, he never ran a single successful operation. George Smiley is a master spy, running, and everything he does works. And Carla is also a terrifyingly effective opponent, which is what makes the struggle between them such an epic struggle. So I don't think he's either.
All right. Fair enough. Bit of both, maybe. Maybe more effective at manipulating women than running and spying.
Yeah, he might. Well, it's not even really a Peter Gwillem. I mean, Peter Gwillem is a sort of mid-rank, but intelligence officer, but someone who's been through the wars, both metaphorically and literally. He's very much someone who only operated at a very junior level. But in his head, what is he in his... Well, actually, somebody in America made an interesting comment that in his head, I mean, the way he behaved with these women was like James Bond. He would arrive with these women, and he would, with, you know, vintage champagne, with caviar, he would take them to very expensive hotels where they say, "Pleased to see you again, Mr. whatever pseudonym he was using." And, you know, he would have always book into a suite. So he was very much living the high life in that sense of James Bond. He's much more like James Bond than George Smiley in his private life.
That's one of the wonderful paradoxes, isn't it? That in some ways his private life was in fact what he was reacting against.
Yes.
In his writing.
Yeah, it's extraordinary.
Well, thank you so much. Amazing insights into an absolutely fascinating man, and a book that I'd recommend to anybody listening or watching this. Really good.
Yes, book. Both the biography and the new book. I think that you've justified the case for a separate book. I mean, in some ways, you've got to be grateful to the editor leaving.
Yes. I'm sad about him leaving, but yes. I mean, I think it enabled me to focus on these issues and the biographical issues. The difficulty of writing a book about a living person. There is an element in which the book is about the story behind the story. So it's not just about the revelations, but it's also about the struggle to publish those revelations and the degree to which he tried to hold me back, and I was straining to go forward.
Well, I do recommend it. Thank you very much.
No, it's been great. Thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Leave you to
it. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Scandalmongers podcast. This has been a Podcast World production. You can get in contact with our show by emailing team@podcastworld.org, placing Scandalmongers in the heading, or via our social media links within the show's bio.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Want to get a chiseled look in the jawline? Sculpt and shape your jawline with added volume from Juvederm Volux XC. Juvederm Volux XC is an injectable gel specifically designed to be robust enough to improve moderate to severe loss of jawline definition. And it is the first and only hyaluronic acid filler approved for the jawline. Add volume to your jawline for a chiseled look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you. Visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.